We're going to be looking at a story this morning. We're working through the book of Genesis and studying, working through the stories of Genesis. We're going to be looking at a story about a guy who's just got all kinds of issues. He's just deceitful, dishonest, always twisting things to make his life perfect. But as we kind of look at this story, I just want us to wrestle with who he is, kind of as a challenge to not be like Jacob. In the midst of that, I got some questions I want you to wrestle with, kind of more questions about us as a church. Who do we want to become? What sort of people are we going to be like? How do we get there? How do we become the type of people that God can use? If there are hurting, hopeless, helpless people here in Eureka who have desperate needs, are we going to be the type of church that God would trust us to send them to? See, I think that's a core issue that we need to wrestle with. I believe that God works in different ways. I believe sometimes God sends people in our lives because we have problems and he wants to expose those. Sometimes he sends people in our lives because we aren't really following him wholeheartedly and he wants us to show us, wants to show us that. I also believe sometimes God sends people in our lives because we do trust him. And we're the type of people that God says, all right, here's this person who needs Jesus. Let me send them to the people that would show them Jesus. I want us to be that type of church. I want us to be the type of church that God literally would trust with hurting people who have issues and problems, who may not look like us, who may not talk like us, who may not act like us, but because we are willing to be transparent and honest and love Jesus, God will send them our way. Jacob is not that type of guy. In the book of Genesis, it's actually written by a guy named Moses. Moses writes the book of Genesis several hundred years, actually about 400 years after these stories here. But as he writes them, he is writing them to God's people, the Jewish people, as they go through God's great miracle of moving them from Egypt, where they had been in slavery, to this land that God had promised, which is Israel. And they're in this great miracle that God does, but one of the things that they have to wrestle with is our heritage. Who are we? Where did we come from? Why are we a special people? What is it about us that makes us important? And so Moses is giving them the book of Genesis to help them understand who they came from. And the truth of the matter is they came from a very dysfunctional family, a very messed up situation. It all points to God's grace. There's no heroes in Genesis except God, except Jesus. He's the only hero. All these people have issues, but in the midst of it, we see God moving in the life of this guy, Jacob, in a great way. Jacob's grandpa was a guy named Abram. Abraham was followed God, trusted God. God called him from a life of serving many gods to serving the one true God. And Abraham was a man of great faith. And even in the midst of this, Abraham didn't have any children until he was 100 years old. God finally gave Abraham and his wife Sarah a son. That son's name was Isaac. Isaac, too, became a man who trusted God. But they had two kids, Jacob and Esau. And these kids have issues from day one, from their birth. They're already fighting. Jacob gets the name heel grabber because literally as these twin boys are being born, Jacob is grabbing the heel of his older brother, already wanting to fight with him. And Jacob, this is just his character. All the way through the story, Jacob is this guy who is always trying to get people to buy the heel and cheat them and deceive them and be dishonest with them so that his life is the way he wants it to be, not so that his life is honoring God or anything else. All the way through the story, Jacob is constantly setting people up, tricking them, cheating them. He does this with his brother. He literally steals his brother's place in the family. As the older brother, his brother had the right to half the inheritance. His brother had the right to be the leader of the family. And Jacob literally uses deceit twice. First with a bowl of red beans and rice. And the second time with just deceiving his father by dressing up like his brother. He literally steals his brother's place in the family. And then Jacob is run out of town because Jacob's kind of the girly man. You know, he's kind of a prissy, soft dude, you know. And his brother is He-Man, you know, I am, you know, hunter and I will kill you kind of guy. And so Esau, his brother, literally runs him out of town. And as he's running away from his brother, he ends up encountering the living God. But we even saw in that story, if you were here last week, we saw in that story that Jacob even tries to play con games with God. Jacob builds a pillar, he builds an altar, he has this encounter with God, but he kind of compartmentalizes his life and he walks away and goes on with his life, kind of leaving God at this place called Bethel, like you can do that. But he goes on about his life. There's not a whole lot of change in Jacob. But the thing you need to realize is that even though Jacob left God there, God didn't leave Jacob there. God is going to work in Jacob's life, and he's going to bring some people into his life that show Jacob who he really is. That's what I want you to understand this morning. I want you to understand this is how God works, okay? God will either bring people into our lives because of our character, or he will bring people in our lives to change our character. God will either bring people in our lives to test us and try us and to show us who we really are, or he will bring people in our lives because our character honors God and he can trust them with us. Now, that's a nice dividing line. Sometimes it's a little of both. Sometimes God will bring someone in our life that is a lot like us, but they need Jesus, and they test us a little bit, but at the same time, we are able to share Christ with them and show Christ to them as much as we can. Maybe we struggle with that. But I really believe that God will bring people into our lives to try our character, to test us. That's what goes on with Jacob in the story. Or he will bring people into our lives because of who we are. And he will use us and trust us with people who are hurting. That's the challenge this morning. Which are we going to be? Are we going to be the type of church that God is constantly bringing people in here to show us how messed up we are and how self-centered, how we are a church who live our lives all about me? Or are we going to be a church at Genesis that give ourselves away in such a way that when people come here, God will literally send people here who have all kinds of hurts and issues so that we can show them Jesus? Jacob is the first. He is all about himself. And we're going to look at a story that's just weird, okay? We're literally going to look at three chapters of the Bible, and I'm going to give you as much as I can this morning. It's a lot of story. People are drawn to stories, and I hope you kind of follow the dots in a story. I really hope I'm not so random that you kind of miss the story as I tell it this morning. But three chapters of the Bible. If you have your Bibles, we're going to start in Genesis chapter 29. If you don't have a Bible at the end of your row, there's Bibles there for you. We'd love for you to take one, use it this morning. We'll start on page 20 in that Bible this morning. If you don't have a Bible at home that's yours, we'd love for you to keep that as our gift to you. Take that home with you. We're going to be looking at this guy, Jacob, who is a guy who's met God, yes, but he's still living his life all about me. He's still kind of twisted. He's still kind of a deceiver, but God puts people in his life. And I want to tell you, as you read this story, this is what it's going to feel like. It's going to feel like a Jerry Springer episode. I promise you. You're going to hear people in the background going, Jerry, Jerry, Jerry. You're going to hear these people just fighting. It's psycho. I mean, you can almost imagine reading this story as Jacob is sitting on a stage trying to tell the story. And every once in a while, here comes his father-in-law, Laban, ready to fight him. And the guys have to break him up. And then all of a sudden, these two sisters are like duking it out, you know. And the guards, you know, are separating them. And they're calling each other every name in the book. And that's what's going on. It's a freak show. But the reason this story happens is because God has to put Jacob in a situation. He has to put this cheater, this deceiver in a situation where he now is the one constantly being deceived. And what God does is exposes in Jacob who he really is. Have you ever noticed that if you have major issues in your life, God has this incredible ability to bring people around you that are just like you, but worse? I mean, I've seen it happen. You know, this person is kind of a gossip. I mean, she's the person who just talks about people. She's just got all kinds of, you know, did you hear about so-and-so? Did you hear about so-and-so? And then all of a sudden, this other person shows up, and she is like mad, like ready to kick the cat, scream at somebody, throw something across the room mad because that girl was talking about her. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever noticed that somebody who is a thief, somehow God brings somebody in their life who just steals from them, and how ticked off they get when like they get robbed. That God just has this ability to do that. God does this in Jacob's life. He brings these people who are him times four. And that's the story. We're going to be looking at this and kind of to set up the story. What happens is Jacob continues his travels. He's left his homeland. He has gone to this place called Bethel. This is where God spoke to him. And now he keeps traveling back to the home of his mother. about 400 miles away. It's a long walk. He's had a lot of time to think, but he's still the same old miserable cuss that he was before. He shows up at his mom's homeland, and he's going to meet his uncle Laban and his daughters. When he gets there, they're shepherds, so the sheep come up to this place, and there's this watering hole. Scene one takes place at this watering hole. There's this watering hole that has a huge rock over it. And Jacob is kind of, you know, like I said, he's kind of the prissy. He's the Will and Grace guy. He's, you know, no hair. Hair's just all right. Every morning he gets up, whips out the mirror and puts all the products in his hair and just looks perfect and smells right. He's got the Axe stuff. He sprays it, you know. And, you know, he just is this kind of a, you know, girly guy, you know, a little feminine, a little comfortable with this feminine side. This is Jacob, you know. He shows up at this watering hole. And these shepherds start showing up, you know, and they're just stinky men with burlap on. They don't care how they look. They just have sheep, care for sheep. But there, at this watering hole, there is this rock that is covering the watering hole. And while he's sitting there watching these sheep coming up, wondering if he's in the right place, if he's at his uncle Laban's area, here comes this hot, gorgeous, drop dead, look at that woman, woohoo, chick named Rachel. And she walks up with some sheep. And now she wants her sheep watered. This rock was so big that these shepherds who'd come up, they were waiting for everybody to show up. This girl shows up, Rachel, and he's like, look at me. I'm a tough guy. You know, he says it with conviction. And he walks over and he picks up the rock and he literally moves it. In verse 9, chapter 29, verse 9, we're picking up the story. It says, while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came to her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. As soon as Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob came near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban. How many of you guys have seen, like, you know, this sophomore guy who has the hots for a girl? And a sophomore guy couldn't fight his way out of a wet paper bag, right? You know, he just, if he got in a fair fight with himself, he'd still lose. This is, you know, and all of a sudden this sophomore guy sees this girl. He's got arms this big around, but he stands, he starts, you know, doing the stance. He starts looking all tough and rough and manly because this girl he likes. I mean, you know, men, we're pathetic about that. We like showing ourselves off and proving we are manly men, huh? Because we want the girl to notice, and we may be the biggest pansies in the world, but that's okay. When the girl we like walks by, we're going to look. This is what Jacob does, you know. Jacob runs from his manly brother who's, you know, going to bow hunt and all that stuff. He runs from him, but when he sees Rachel, oh, I'm man, I will move rock, you know. And he moves this rock out of the way, and now shepherd's like, wow, that's pretty cool. And Rachel's like, woo. And so the Bible goes on and says, look at this. Verse 11, Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. Okay, so the girly man thing came out. Rachel now thinks, hey, look at that. He's like, yo, baby, you and me, we're going to hook up. And he starts kissing on her, but then he starts crying like a little girl. What a dude, man. Oh, you're just beautiful. Anyway, so they end up going back to Uncle Laban's. His uncle, Rachel, takes him back and introduces him to her father, Laban. And they get to know each other, and Laban at first is all excited, and he makes a statement. Look at verse 14. Laban said to him, surely you are bone of my bone, or my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him a month. Interesting phrase. Because what Laban is, it's kind of like, you know, as you tell stories, you insert little secrets and little foreshadowing. Jacob's name literally means I live life all about me. And Laban says, man, you're my bone and my flesh. You're just like me. And there's a little foreshadowing going on here because Laban is Jacob times two. Laban is the king of deceivers. He is the king of con men. And for the next 20 years of his life, literally, Jacob is going to be conned and deceived and just messed up and run over and treated badly. And everything that Jacob ever did is going to come back and haunt him. In chapter 29, it goes on that Jacob kind of falls in love with Rachel. And so Uncle Laban sees this as this great opportunity. And he says, what do you know, you come work for me. What do you want as your wages? I'll pay you, Jacob. And Jacob says, all right, here's what I want. I will work for you for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, I want your daughter Rachel as my wife. Guys, do you have any girl you'd work 7 years for? When you get married, you will, okay? You work for the rest of your life for him. Anyway, that's just a side note. Anyway, 7 years, okay? The guy, Jacob, says, oh, I'm just so in love with her. She is so beautiful. I just think the world of her. I will work 7 years. Now, the interesting thing is Laban is already conning him because the going rate for women that back then was 4 years. Not that that's all you're worth, ladies, but here's what's going on. Jacob is going to work 7 years. In that 7 years, what Laban's supposed to do is take the wages he would pay Jacob and put it into what was called a dowry. A dowry was basically life insurance for the bride. The father of the bride would take that money and would put it aside so that if the husband died, the wife would now have something to live on. That's what it was supposed to be. So Jacob's saying, I'll work 7 years. You put my wages aside. And as you put my wages aside, I will in 7 years marry your daughter. And when I marry your daughter, you take that money. And then if something happens to me, if I run off, if I'm a pig and I run off, or if I die or something, she'll be taken care of. But I'm going to work 7 years. The going rate was four. So already he's counting them into 3 extra years. But then we have the most awkward moment in the whole Bible. Chapter 29, if you have it, flip over there. Chapter 29, we'll look at verses 21 through 27. Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. 7 years have gone by, and he comes and he says, dude, I've waited long enough. I want my wife. I want her now. For my time is completed. Laban gathered together all the people of the place and made a feast. But in the evening, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. All right. Jerry. This is what happens, okay? First of all, you got to get our whole idea of a wedding out of your head. Now, if you're like uncomfortable with this, I'm really sorry. But I'm just telling you what happens in the Bible so you see this picture. This is not this beautiful ceremony where here comes this bride in the white gown with a veil over her face, and the husband lifts her, you know, and kisses her, and they have a ceremony, and then they play bait and switch. The way weddings happened in ancient culture was like this. This is weird, okay? I would not be cool with this, all right? But this is true. This is what happened, all right? The father-in-law would throw a feast. At the feast, the whole day, or the whole time this feast was going on, there would be lots of, you know, wine and lamb and all kinds of good food. The bride would wear a veil. And as the bride would wear a veil, she would be parted, but she would never really be together with the groom. In the evening, when it was dark, no lights, no, you know, little fluorescent, you know, best I can do is a candle, she would go into her tent and they would go get married. Okay, no ceremony. Getting married meant they hung out. They slept together. They, you know, did the thing husbands and wives did. Meanwhile, everybody else is outside the tent. Weird stuff, okay? In the morning, they would come out, and then the father would provide a ceremony that affirmed the marriage that took place in the tent overnight. Okay, listen, guys, mental note. When you get married, do not tell people which hotel room you go to, because it would be an awkward moment to open the tent and there's your family, okay? Not comfortable. But this is what goes on. And so Laban comes up with this crazy scheme. He's got two daughters too. Daughter one, Leah, the older daughter, the Bible says she had like a lazy eye. She's not, in fact, the name Leah, if y'all know Leah Dumi, don't go tell her this, okay? The name Leah means cow. All right, this is my daughter, Cow. She's got a lazy eye. This is who this chick is, okay? Rachel means you, beautiful little lamb. Now, here's part of what's hilarious. Here's this guy, Laban, and his daughters are walking billboards. I named my daughters Cow and Lamb because I'm a shepherd. Woo! The dude is messed up. Jerry. Anyway, and so he holds this feast, puts a veil over her head, over Leah's head, sends her into the tent. Here's the awkward moment. They do what married people do and fall asleep. The sun comes up, the birds are singing. Jacob wakes up, looks over at his new wife, and goes, Leah, what the heck are you doing here? Awkward moment. I mean, that would not be cool, okay? He is not real happy about this because in ancient culture, guess what? They are now married. Boom. He has been conned. Now, here's the thing about this. It's really interesting. This whole story, Jacob gets everything he did. If you remember the story, Jacob deceived his brother, cheated his brother. And Jacob basically despised the position of his older brother being the leader of the family and robbed that of him. But when he goes and finds his uncle Laban, says, "What have you done to me?" Laban's response is, "Listen, in our culture, the older one gets married first. I don't know why you're so upset about this." You don't know why I'm upset about this? You got to be kidding me. I wake up in the morning and the wrong woman's in my bed? That's not a good thing, you know? And Laban's like, "Well, you probably had too much to drink, dude. Feast, party. I don't know what's wrong with you, but, you know, we marry the oldest one first." Jacob despised the family position that he was put in and wanted to be the leader. And now his uncle Laban turns the cards on him. The second thing right here is that he played masquerade. If you remember the story, he dressed up like Esau and put on skins and dressed up like this, you know, smelly, hairy He-Man and went into his father who was blind and going deaf and acted like Esau. And now Laban sends one daughter in masqueraded as another. Everything that he did comes right back on him. You know, can you feel the, you know, people, you know, now Jacob's ready to go after Laban and the guys have to step in between them and break them up. Jerry. Anyway, and so the story goes on. I mean, that's just awkward. And Jacob says, "What do I do?" And Laban says, "All right, here's the deal. You spend a week with Leah, you know, the one with the weird eye and, you know, that doesn't smell right and hadn't shaved and, you know, spend a week with her, okay? And then at the end of a week, I will give you my other daughter to be your wife." Now, here's the thing, guys, we're just weird, and not all guys are like this, but there's a lot of guys who will read this and go, "Sisters, yes, my dream," you know, because men are just stupid. And that's probably at first what Jacob is going, "Sisters." It is one, listen, they are not going to get along. This is not a good idea, okay? First of all, having two wives, not a good idea, period. I don't understand why in the Bible they want to do this. But then two wives who are sisters, that is just like a recipe for disaster. And so, spend a week, I will give you Rachel. And the two of them get married. Same ordeal, they go in a tent. This time he's like, "Hey, you are Rachel, right?" "Yeah, okay, cool." And they consummate their marriage. Both of these women, these sisters, now they also have servants who their father gives to them. There's these four women who are now part of this family. And it is the biggest freak show. They have 12 kids. And as you read the story about these 12 kids, it is totally the situation where these two sisters are fighting and using Jacob just as the middleman. He's just a hunk of meat to these two women. Leah wants more than anything. This girl who's not pretty, who's not attractive, wants more than anything to be loved by her husband. But the Bible tells us that Jacob loved Rachel and despised Leah. All her heart longs for is to be loved by this guy. On the other hand, Rachel, more than anything, she doesn't really care about the love of her husband because she has that. She wants children. And God doesn't allow her to have children for a long time. And it's like this fight because she wants love, she wants kids, she gets love. And each one is getting what the other one yearns for. And they fight, and they start having kids. It starts off with, and this is all, the rest of chapter 29 into chapter 30, they have these 12 kids. And what's crazy about the names of these 12 kids, some of them you'll read them, you'll go, "Oh, that's neat." Because, like, they name them names that mean something. Like, for example, the name Judah means praise, and we read that and go, oh, what a great name, praise the Lord. Listen, none of these names are all, the context is the fight between these two sisters. You know, they're now up on stage throwing chairs at each other and, you know, fighting, and the way they fight is by naming their kids, all right? And first, Leah has four children. The first children is a kid named Reuben. Reuben is means see a son. She holds up her kid in front of Rachel and goes, huh, I got a boy. She has another child. That child's name is Simeon, meaning God heard. And now she's looking at her sister going, huh, hey, Rachel, God heard me. He ain't hearing you. Ha, ha, ha. The third name, the name of the third son is Levi. That doesn't mean genes, okay? Levi, which means attached, meaning my husband's going to like me now. Yeah, I've given him three boys. He's going to like me. He's not going to like you. And the fourth son she has is named Judah. She's going around, oh, praise the Lord, oh, praise the Lord, I have a son and you ain't got none. You know, that's her attitude. And she names these kids. It is all related to her fight with her sister. Well, her sister is not having children. So she goes, I got this really cool idea. I'm going to send my servant in. She's going to have children. I'll just take them as my own, which was a practice back then. Not a good practice, not a godly practice. It was a practice. And so her servant, Bilhah, goes in. And she has a son named Dan, which means God judged between me and you, and now I'm the good one. So now, you know, Rachel is naming the son Dan. And then the second son was named Naphtali, which means, how'd you like to name your kid that? I'm going to name my son Naphtali, which means I fought my sister and I won, you know. I'm better than she is. How'd you like to have that name? What's your name? Naphtali. Dude, that means like sisters fighting. What's that all about? But that's how they're naming their kids. Well, then Leah, who is no longer having children, probably because Jacob got to the point where he's like, you know what? I'm tired of you. I don't need any more kids by you. You're a crazy woman. I don't like you. I really like your sister better. She comes up with this crazy idea of sending her servant in. And Zilpah has two children, Gad, which means good fortune, and Asher, which means happy. Once again, neither one of these names are about, I have good fortune. It's pointing back to the sister saying, well, I'm the one with good fortune now. I'm the one who's happy now. And then the craziest story in the midst of this, one of Leah's sons, her oldest son, Reuben. This is in chapter 29, chapter 40, verses 14 through 18. One of her oldest sons, her oldest son, Reuben, is out in the wheat harvest, and he finds some mandrakes. He finds fruit. But it was a type of fruit that people believed back then that if you ate the fruit, it would make women fertile, okay? And so her son comes back in with these mandrakes and says, Leah takes them and is like, hey, I've got mandrakes. I've got fruit. Rachel looks and says, can I have some? I want to have a baby, and I like fruit. Can I have some mandrakes? They make a deal. Here's the deal. Leah says, fine, you can have some mandrakes, but tonight he comes and sleeps with me. How weird. You know, they're like bartering him, just like he bartered his brother for a bowl of soup. His brother sold his birthright for a bowl of soup. They are selling him for fruit. By the way, who's supposed to name the kids in Old Testament culture? The dad. He doesn't name any of them. This is so weird. You know, it's just this freak show thing. Anyway, so I need to get through this. Rachel Leah ends up having three more sons. One of them is named Issachar, which means hire. I hired my husband and this is the result. I mean, there you go. You know, I pimped out my husband. Here's the kid. That's your name, you know. And then Zebulun, which means honor, meaning God honored me, but once again, kind of tongue in cheek. Eventually, Rachel has a son and his name is Joseph. We're going to get to Joseph in a few weeks. Joseph ends up being a great kid. He's the one in this whole family who's not a freak. The story goes on. The rest of chapter 30 ends up like this. Jacob goes to Laban and says, you know what? You have cheated me for 14 years. I want to take my family and leave. And Laban says, listen, I was like, went to a Ouija board or a crystal ball last night, and through divination, I found out that the reason I'm so rich and blessed is because you're here. Name your wages and I'll give them to you. For the next 6 years, basically, Jacob keeps saying, pay me this and I'll stay. Laban agrees and then keeps cheating him. And he ends up with a few sheep and a few goats. But every time his herd, he's going to kind of go into business for himself while he takes care of his uncle's flocks. It's kind of the idea. And every time he tries to get his own herd, Laban keeps changing the game and cheating him. And finally, he gets ticked off and he's like, I'm out of here. And he says, he goes to his family and says, we're leaving. They despise their father now because what Laban did with their dowry was spend it on himself. And they're like, you know, our father even sold us to you and took the money and ran. Let's go. And these 12 kids, or actually 11, there's a 12th, I'll come later. 11 kids, all of them are, most of them are toddlers at this point, up to about 7 or 8 years old maybe. And Jacob and his wife scam out of their wives. These four women, freak show, Jerry Springer show. Laban chases them down, catches them. They end up kind of having this argument. They end up making this pact with one another and build this pillar. And this pillar, they say, you don't cross it, I won't cross it. I don't like you, you don't like me. You know, it's the big guard in the middle of the Jerry Springer show who's going, nope, you on this side, you on this side. And then they had this cute little prayer that people pray. May the Lord watch over you while we're away. And people put this on necklaces and stuff. And it's, from this text, bad use of scripture, because what he's saying is, when I can't see you, God's watching you. And if you cheat me, he's going to get you. That's what he's saying. They don't like each other. They don't trust each other. Jacob is a broken dude who has spent 20 freaking years of his life wasted. He's got a psycho family who's messed up and all kinds of issues. And the Hebrew people are reading this going, dude, these are our like grandparents. We're messed up people. This is who we came from. And the question is, they probably ask when they get to the end of this story, is this, if this is our family, how are we God's people? The rest of the book of Genesis, starting next week, begins how God takes this messed up bunch and begins transforming them into champions. He's going to do it in the life of Jacob very specifically next week. They wrestle. God and Jacob wrestle. They smack down, you know. And then from there, God lets some things happen in the lives of the kids. There's one son, Joseph, who is a godly dude. And through the life of that kid, he literally transforms his family. But the question I have for us today, just kind of in closing, is what do we need to do as a church to not be that way? I mean, here's this guy. God put people in his life because he was wicked, twisted deceiver. And Jacob ends up with a group of people who are worse than he is. Now his whole family, when we end this story, the relationships he has are Laban, who is him times two, these two fighting sisters, and 11 messed up kids who are all children of this psycho dysfunctional family with weird names that reflect this fight. That's Jacob's life now. I would prefer for us to be a people that God trusts, and he sends people to us because of our character, not to prove our character. I was in a church once. Before I got to this church, it was all Anglo church, all white people. And a black couple visited the church one Sunday. When this black couple visited the church, they enjoyed the Sunday service, but they went home. And one of the pastors of the church called them later that day and said, we're really glad you were here. Did you enjoy it? And they said, yeah, we enjoyed the service, but we won't be back. Why won't you be back? Well, the person didn't leave their name, but they did say they were part of the church. And they called us and said, hey, listen, we don't want any of your type here. Can you believe that? And God was exposing in that church the kind of character that was inside that church. About 5 years later, God sent another black family. This black family was from Haiti, and they loved Jesus like passionately. And when they showed up, their whole family, they talked different, they walked different, they just had a different feel, but they loved Jesus. And God put that family smack dab in the middle of that church to transform the character of that church. And literally, that family did. They eventually ordained that man as a deacon, as a leader of the church, and then they ordained him as a missionary to go back to Haiti. But that family was in the church for several years and literally transformed. I hope God sends people to us because he trusts us, not because he feels like he has to change us. To do that, real fast, I'm just going to list these. I would love to tell you all this kind of stuff and what it all means. But I just want to tell you some things that we need to do. If we're going to be the type of church that God trusts with people, the first thing is that we need to live for the glory of God. We need to live our lives so it's not all about me, but it's all about him. When people look at us, they need to see that our lives reflect Jesus and that we live for him, not for ourselves. That's the type of church that God's going to use. This verse up here says this. It says, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory for the sake of your steadfast love and your faithfulness. Jacob said, not to you, O Lord, but to my name give glory. We need to be the type of people to say, not to us, Jesus, but to your name we give glory. The second thing we need to do, if we're going to be the type of people that God uses and trusts with hurting needy people, is this. We need to love people, even the unlovable. See, one of the problems that Jacob ends up having is that he despises the uglier sister. There's a church around here. I couldn't believe when I heard this story. They were asking a sending agency for missionaries to come help them. And they said, but when you send us college students, listen to this, we only want the pretty ones. See, we're reaching pretty people. And we don't want somebody who will show up and won't reflect that. Couldn't believe when I heard that. Listen, we need to be the type of church that loves even the unlovable people, the people who are hurting, the people who will come with questions, the people who come with issues. Mark Driscoll wrote a book. He's a guy in Seattle. He said he's had these questions. If we had people who showed up with these questions, how would we respond? Can I pierce or tattoo any part of my body? If I'm HIV positive, if I'm an HIV positive new Christian, can I still get married someday? What words count as swearing? Who decides this? And if I disagree, can I cuss them out? Are we ready to answer people who show up who have these kind of questions? Are we ready to deal with the people in our culture who are not necessarily the pretty people or the perfect people who look just like us and act just like us? Are we ready to reach out to people who are the Leahs of this world, who are the people who are struggling, who have issues? Maybe it's physical, maybe it's emotional. Are we ready to wrestle with those people? Can God trust us with those type of people? Or will we be the type of church who just internalizes, gets with our clique, gets with our group of people, lives life all about me? We don't care about who else shows up as long as I'm happy. I don't want to be that kind of church. I don't want to be like Jacob. A third thing that we can do is this, that we need to do. We need to hold on to principles and let go of preferences. Here's what I mean. Principles are the things that God has given us. Things like the gospel. That's a big one. The good news that Jesus died for us. He paid the penalty on the cross for my sin. He rose again. He's the only way to heaven. That's a principle. I believe that wholeheartedly. We're not giving that up. Country music, for some, is a preference. For me, it's not. I don't understand country music. Oxymoron. It's two words that should not go together. For example, a country song, if my nose was full of nickels, I'd blow it all on you. I mean, that's just not cool kind of music, you know? What has 76 legs and 26 teeth? Front row at a Willie Nelson concert. I mean, you know, I just am not a country music guy. But guess what? I love Jesus. And if we are in a culture where country music is something that would reach people, I need to let go of my preferences. Be okay with Genesis doing some country music. Cry in the back while it's happening. But be more concerned about reaching people than having my way. You guys, I've been in a lot of churches where they were driven by preferences. They would let go of principles, but don't mess with that organ. Meanwhile, the culture around them, the only place they ever heard an organ was at the Cardinal game here and there. They walk into a church and go, organ? Never heard one of those, like for real. We need to let go of preferences, hold on to principles. Last thing is this. We need to be a group that lets mission be our priority, meaning we are here to reach Eureka and beyond. People who are all about me say, they're out there. They'll show up if they want to. We need to be the type of people that says, no, we're going. We are going to reach this community. We need to be about the mission God's given us, and that mission is this area. I love Eureka. We went to the football game Friday night. Loved it. Part of what was going on in my heart, though, was I was sitting there going, God, help us as a church meet these people, get to know them, and tell them about Jesus. It was kind of exciting. I don't know if you guys know this, but in the Eureka football guide, there's a big old, you know, they have the program that they give at every game. We put an ad in there this year. I was kind of shocked. We're the only church with an ad. And we actually did the ad that's, you know, a full color right on the back of the team photo ad. It's pretty cool. Except right underneath our ad is a picture of a half-naked woman. It's kind of weird, you know, because it's a spa ad, you know. And so I wasn't quite sure what to do with that. But I was like, you know what? People will look at our ad more because of that. So I guess that's okay, you know. It's just the way it worked out. But I just felt like that was a way to say to Eureka, we are here and we love you. You're our mission. That's what we're about. Okay, there it is. We don't want to be like Jacob. We want to be the type of people God trusts. But here's the thing. It's all about Jesus. It's all about grace. These 12 kids end up being 12 tribes. Those 12 tribes become the Jewish people. And the Bible tells us, now watch this. At the end of time, we're going to go to heaven. If you know Jesus, you have a relationship with him, you've trusted him with your life, you're going to go to a very real place that is called heaven. The best thing about heaven is that Jesus is going to be there. That's the best thing. We're going to be able to hang out with him. But when we get there, the imagery of heaven is that there's these gates all around this huge city. That's the way God has pictured it for us in Revelation chapter 21. And over the door of each of these gates is the name of one of these freak kids that we met this morning. And I look at that and I go, how? And the answer is that we are all in that same situation. The only reason the 12 names of the 12 sons of Jacob are over the doors, the gates of the heavenly city, is that God changed them. And the only way I'm getting into that heavenly city is if God changes me. Grace, meaning he gives me what I don't deserve. And that comes through trusting Jesus Christ alone. Giving my life to him, giving my heart to him. And so that's one of the challenges. If you don't know Jesus this morning, trust him. He will take you. You may feel like one of these kids. Your name really ought to be Naphtali. My mom and dad wrestled all the time. They fought all the time. That's really what my name ought to be. God can make that beautiful. Trust him. You may be here this morning. You may say, you know, I'm really like Jacob. I live my life all about me. I want to tell you, just turn to Jesus and trust him. Follow him. God will change you. He's good that way. But when he does, we want you to come to Genesis and be a part of church that God will trust when people are hurting. We put together a little slideshow. Next week is the commemoration of September 11th. This last week was kind of the first anniversary of Katrina and that disaster. As you're watching this, here's the question. If this sort of disaster happened here, would we be the type of church that turns in and takes care of ourselves? Or would we be the type of church that gives ourselves away to impact the world around us? Can God trust us with the hurting if something like this happened?